country music and barbecue. That's still true, but Houston is now rated by the Washington Post as one of the 5 best restaurant cities in the United States. It has an excellent opera and claims to have more theater space than any city except New York, achievements that mark Houston's aspiration to be an international cultural center. There was this ad in Texas Monthly, Lynn Wyatt, the long-reigning queen of the Houston social scene, told me. It said Houston is, what's that awful word? Funky. It said Houston is funky. I called them up at once. I told them, Houston's not funky. You make it sound like Austin or some such place. Houston is a world-class city. I spent some time in the early 1980s writing about the space program, so I hung around the Johnson Space Center, which is in the Clear Lake area of Houston. A massive Saturn V rocket, the kind that took the astronauts to the moon, reclines on its side at the entryway, like some fallen colossus of an ancient world. After the glamour days of the race to the moon, the space program had become more prosaic, more workaday, more lunchboxy. I remember seeing the Columbia, the first of the shuttle fleet to fly into space, as it passed over our house in 1981, piggybacked atop a 747 on its way to Cape Canaveral. It was exciting and pitiable at the same instant. That's a rocket ship? A new generation of astronauts had arrived, and the tone of the Space Center changed. For one thing, they weren't all white men. Franklin Chang Diaz was a plasma physicist from MIT. He was born in Costa Rica and was part Chinese. He showed up on his first day at the Johnson Space Center driving a rusted-out Renault sedan, its doors held shut with ropes, and occupied the same spot where the legendary Wally Schirra, one of the original Mercury 7, once parked his Maserati. There were still some dashing test pilots among the new group, drawn from the military ranks, like Charles Bolden, a cheerful Marine who would one day become the first black administrator of NASA. Sally Ride, a physicist, was the first American woman in space. Judith Resnick, the first American Jewish astronaut, was a classical pianist and an electrical engineer. Ronald McNair got his doctorate in laser physics from MIT. He had a black belt in karate and played the saxophone. What really impressed me was that he had integrated the library in Lake City, South Carolina, where he grew up, refusing to leave until he was allowed to check out books. His mother and the police were called, but he was finally allowed to become the first black child to borrow books. He was 9 years old. I was a little infatuated with the whole group. They were bright and fit. You could see them running around the track like ponies. There was an emergency room surgeon from Murfreesboro, Tennessee, Ray Seddon, who took me to lunch in her Corvette. She was also a jet pilot and probably had other skills, such as speaking Mandarin or playing the xylophone. As we raced down NASA Road 1, I looked over at Dr. Seddon with her long blonde tresses tossed about like an advertisement for Clairol, and an unfamiliar thought leaped into my mind. I want to have your baby. I quickly pushed that aside. I wrote a profile of one of the early women in the astronaut corps, Mary Cleave, a diminutive woman with an infectious cackle and gray-green eyes that were twice as sharp as normal, pilot's eyes. But her specialty was sanitary engineering, one area that the geniuses at NASA had never really figured out. The first American in space, Alan Shepard, had to pee in his spacesuit. After that, there were diapers and a fecal collection bag that fit over the hips like a pair of Bermuda shorts. Most astronauts in the early days forced themselves to wait until they got home to defecate. The first true space potty featured a seat that the astronaut could strap himself into. A fan created differential air pressure to simulate gravity, and air jets directed the feces away from the anus. For urination, there was a funnel that fit over the penis. But the potty still needed to be modified to accommodate women, and that's where Mary came in. She joined the astronaut corps in May 1980. A year later, she got to see the first launch of Columbia, which went flawlessly, except for the fact that the potty broke. When my profile of her came out in Texas Monthly, Mary was on the cover, in her astronaut suit, with that giant globe space helmet in her hand. I blithely signed a form, obligating me to pay for the helmet if it broke as I ferried it over to the photographer. $500,000. The astronauts represented the best of America, it seemed to me. They were marvelously accomplished but surprisingly modest, serious but upbeat, and of course their courage was unquestioned. Many of them had sacrificed high-paying positions at universities or in medical practice to take a government job at a fraction of their previous earnings. To a person, they were motivated by grand visions of moving humanity into space. My friend Steve had also covered the space program, so we decided to write a screenplay. It was called Moonwalker, about one of the old Apollo guys who gets back into the program and falls in love with a new woman astronaut. Like so many Hollywood scripts, it was always on the verge of getting made. We went to Cape Canaveral to watch the launch of STS-9, along with our friend Gregory Curtis, then the editor of Texas Monthly. For each of us, it was one of the most thrilling sights we had ever witnessed, despite the fact that the stands were 3 miles away from the launch pad. What had been the hazy blip on the horizon suddenly began spewing flames so intense that even at such a distance you wondered if watching them would damage your eyes, Greg later wrote. Huge, roiling clouds of water vapor, pure white, billowed up from the base of the rocket, and then the sound arrived. The sonic shock made the ground tremble and knocked shorebirds out of the sky. The spacecraft finally tore itself free of the Earth and climbed into the sky, executing a role that I thought must be dangerous, but was, of course, a natural part of the launch. When it finally disappeared into the clouds, Greg wrote, you continued to watch, with all your nerves revving. To our dismay, Steve and I discovered that we had both applied to be the first journalist in space, a program that NASA had cooked up to generate public interest, which had plummeted once spaceflight became routine. I was jealous of Steve, who I was certain would be chosen, and he was jealous of me. We made a deal. Whichever one of us actually did get picked would place the other's latest book into orbit. Before the journalist in space, however, there was a teacher in space. I had suggested to Roberta that she might want to apply, but she was nonplussed by the idea. Krista McAuliffe, a social studies teacher from Concord, New Hampshire, got the nod. Steve and I were working on a rewrite of Moonwalker on January 28, 1986, when Roberta came down to my office. She had the flu and wasn't teaching that day. "Did you hear about the Challenger?" she asked. The 25th space shuttle mission had exploded. The flight lasted 73 seconds. Then it simply blew to pieces. Weirdly, the announcer continued to broadcast the velocity and distance, even as the capsule, containing those noble lives, fell into the Atlantic Ocean. At least some of the astronauts may have been alive until the capsule hit the water, at more than 200 miles per hour. Among the dead were Krista McAuliffe, the first teacher in space, Judith Resnick, the Jewish-American piano-playing physicist, and Ronald McNair, the saxophonist and physicist. They named the library he integrated in South Carolina after him. Houston's famous Astrodome was for sale, so I hurried over to size up the property, arguably the most historic building in Texas, aside from the Alamo. No city in America may aspire to greatness without sports teams, but the tropical heat and torrential rains played havoc with Houston's mighty ambition. In 1965, Roy Hofhines, a former mayor who was called the judge because of his brief tenure as a county official, opened what was then called the Harris County Dome Stadium. The former eighth wonder of the world has been home at various times to the Houston Astros, the Houston Oilers, the Houston Rockets, and the Houston Livestock Show and Rodeo. But when I visited, it had been sitting empty for 8 years after all the teams ran off to newer venues and the fire department jerked the venue's certificate of occupancy. It was a little sad, honestly, to see this noble landmark out on the streets, as it were. The city had turned its back on the iconic building that made civilization in Houston, and Texas at large, seem somewhat plausible in the first place. Judge Hofhinds was an ideal expression of the Texas go-getter. He gained control of the Colt 45s, a National League expansion team, which he renamed the Astros. The team had only agreed to come to Houston because of the judge's promise to build a covered stadium. Hofhinds claimed to have been inspired by the Roman Colosseum, which in ancient days was shaded by an awning during matinee gladiatorial contests. If the Romans could do it, why not the Houstonians? But shade wasn't enough for the judge. He set out to construct the world's largest air-conditioned room. Such a structure had never been built before. Overheated Texans used to cool their churches and restaurants by placing fans over tubs of ice. Then in 1923, the Second National Bank became the first air-conditioned building in Houston. By the 1950s, Houston laid claim to being the air-conditioning capital of the world, which included the Plaza Americas, the first fully air-conditioned mall. But the building of the Astrodome was a civic leap of faith. It still stands imposingly beside the freeway, like the working end of a gigantic roll-on deodorant, as Texas author Larry McMurtry noted with his unsparing eye. Hofhinds moved into an apartment inside the dome that occupied 7 floors of the right field bleachers and was equipped with a chapel, a bowling alley, a shooting gallery, and a private bar called the Tipsy Tavern. Bob Hope observed the decor and pronounced it early King Farouk. Hofhinds dressed the stadium ushers, attractive young women called spacettes, in quilted golden outfits suitable for the frigid interior climate. The grounds crew, who wore orange jumpsuits with space helmets, were called Earthmen. It was like having your own planet, the judge's widow, Mary Frances Hofhinds, later recalled. Another county judge, Ed Emmett, inherited the Astrodome dilemma when he took office in 2007. Most Houstonians said they'd prefer to have the old stadium torn down and made into green space, and they decisively rejected a bond proposal of $213 million to convert the structure into a multi-use event facility. However, Judge Emmett decided it didn't make financial sense to raise the Astrodome. "It's solid," he told me as we walked around the vast interior. When Hurricane Ike came through in 2008, every other structure in this area was damaged, but not this place. Plus, it's already paid for. Emmett turned to the public for suggestions. About 100 ideas were submitted, some scribbled on bar napkins. Make it a parking garage, a ski slope, a science museum. One suggestion was to flood the arena, which is 2 stories below ground level, and reenact naval battles. Another group proposed turning it into a gigantic movie studio. None of these ideas came with any money attached, Emmett noted, as we stood in what had once been shallow center field, near the spot where Muhammad Ali knocked out Cleveland Williams in 1966. Judy Garland, Elvis Presley, Billie Jean King versus Bobby Riggs. There's an endless roster of memories here. I have a friend who scattered his father's ashes on the playing field. Except for a brief birthday party for the stadium on its 50th anniversary in 2015, the last time the public was admitted was in 2005, when refugees from Hurricane Katrina took shelter here. Emmett favored making the Astrodome's 350,000 square feet of floor space into a giant indoor park, or else simply providing a space for festivals and special events. It's a minimal plan, he admits. We could have the state archery contest here, he said, the Texas horseshoe tournament. I've also got ties to the cricket community. It seemed a long way from opening day, April 9, 1965, when the Astros beat the Yankees 2-1, and Mickey Mantle hit the stadium's first home run. I got a tour in a golf cart with a flashlight through the home team's old locker room, where the hot tub was still intact. Judge Hofhinds also used to prowl around late at night in his golf cart, exploring his creation. The playing field was now given over to storage, much of it from the larger, sleeker NRG Stadium next door. There were stacks of stadium chairs, turnstiles, and a hut for a parking lot attendant. 200 feet above us was the roof with its geometric plastic tiles. When the stadium opened, there was reasonable concern that outfielders wouldn't be able to see the ball, so someone stood on the catwalk overhead and dropped baseballs as Joe Morgan and Rusty Staub raced around struggling to catch them. To reduce the glare, the Lucite panels were painted with a translucent coating, but that killed the grass. Hoffines had the dead grass painted green until he was able to replace it with AstroTurf, a grass-like carpet, which was now lying in massive rolls like hay bales on the concrete stadium floor. The retractable pitcher's mound was buried under a couple of steel plates. Two of my favorite ballplayers, Nolan Ryan and J.R. Richard, once stood on this spot. They were briefly teammates, although Ryan was the one who got the first $1 million contract in baseball history, creating resentment on Richard's part. Both could throw 100-mile-an-hour fastballs and breaking balls at almost that speed, but the 6'8" Richard was by far the more intimidating pitcher. I never saw a pitcher so thoroughly overpower hitters. At the moment he released the ball, his right foot was almost off the mound, and his hand seemed to be right in the batter's face. His slider was probably the most difficult pitch in the game to hit. It was thrilling to watch him. In both 1978 and 1979, he struck out more than 300 hitters, a feat only Nolan Ryan and Sandy Koufax had accomplished in consecutive seasons in the modern era. The following year was expected to be the season that Richard firmly proved himself to be the most dominating pitcher in baseball. He was 30 years old and getting better every year. He won 10 of his first 14 starts. But then he began complaining about a dead arm, along with stiffness in his shoulder and back. He took himself out of several games when he couldn't see the catcher's signs. For weeks he complained of dizziness and pain. Because of his very public gripes about Ryan's contract, fans turned against him, believing he was loafing, although he hadn't missed a start in 5 years. Even the team doctors and staff didn't believe him. The Astros reluctantly put him on the disabled list. "They said it was all in my head," Richard later recalled. "They said I was unhappy, pouting about Ryan." On July 30, 1980, with an earned run average of 1.9, Richard suffered a major stroke from a blood clot in an artery leading to his right arm. Doctors had finally detected it several days earlier, but decided it was stable, and so they did nothing. Richard never played in the big leagues again. After a couple of bad investments and two divorces, he was financially ruined. In January 1995, while Ryan was preparing to start his 27th season in the major leagues, a reporter for the Houston Post found Richard living under a bridge about 3 miles from the Astrodome. Ryan went on to the National Baseball Hall of Fame and served as president of the Texas Rangers. He is said to be worth $60 million. He is one of the most popular Texans of all time. Richard became a minister and got involved in serving the homeless population in Houston. They were two great players, but I wonder how their destinies would have differed if their plights had been reversed. One imagines that Nolan Ryan, the million-dollar man and white, would have been treated as soon as he reported his symptoms. No one would have accused him of being a malingerer and a malcontent. No doubt he would have been rapidly attended to. Perhaps he would have been given better financial advice. On the other hand, Richard was always solitary and difficult. He was known to be using cocaine in his playing days. He was not as easy to make into a hero. Still, I asked Judge Emmett if the fate of the Astrodome was that it, like its predecessor, the Roman Colosseum, would become a venerable ruin. Emmett said he didn't see that happening. Indeed, a few months after my visit, Emmett persuaded the Harris County commissioners to put up $10.5 million to design the redeveloped facility, which would include underground parking and a vast festival area. "The Astrodome's days of sitting idle and abandoned are over," the judge promised. "I'm confident we can do it without a tax increase. $100 million, more or less, is easily doable, in a county with a larger population than 25 states. Houston is the only major city in America without zoning laws. You can build pretty much anything you want, anywhere you want, except in designated historical districts. You'll see some odd sights, such as a two-story family home adjacent to a roller coaster, or an erotic nightclub next to a shopping gallery, or a house made of beer cans. Solo skyscrapers suddenly pop up in residential neighborhoods. The absence of zoning is an artifact of the anti-communist hysteria of the 1950s and 1960s, when zoning was viewed as a communist plot. But there was another group of blacks and liberals who saw an advantage in siding with the ultra-right. Zoning would have been used to keep people out, Bill White, a former mayor, observed. According to City Journal, a publication of the Manhattan Institute for Policy Research, Houston now has the highest standard of living of any large city in America, and among the highest in the world. Personal household income has risen 20% since 2005 in Houston, compared with 14% in New York, 11% in Los Angeles, and less than 9% in Chicago. Parks are being renovated and expanded, and housing is affordable, 60% below the average in Los Angeles, for instance. Houston grew by 35% between 2000 and 2013, an astounding figure for an already mature city. It will soon bypass Chicago to become the country's third largest metropolitan area, behind New York and Los Angeles. All the growth has been Latino, African American, and Asian, the Kinder Institute's Steven Kleinberg said. Houston is now the single most ethnically diverse metro area in the country. One out of four Houstonians is foreign-born, and no single racial or ethnic group constitutes a majority. We speak 142 different languages, Sylvester Turner, Houston's second black mayor, told me. We're seeking to become even more inclusive. For many years, Texas led the nation in the number of refugees, it admits. In 2016, Texas took in 8,300 of the 85,000 refugees that came to America, a close second to California. Under President Trump, the number of refugees permitted into the country has been capped at 45,000. Houston accepts more refugees than any city in the country. At last count, 2010, Texas has the largest number of Muslim adherents in the United States. However, the governor decided in September 2016 to withdraw from the federal resettlement program. Like other cities in Texas, Houston has become more progressive over the years. For instance, 81% of Houston citizens favor background checks for all gun owners, and a majority approves a path to legal citizenship for undocumented immigrants. The proportion of Houstonians identifying themselves as Democrats was 52% in Kleinberg's latest survey, while the number saying they are Republicans declined to 30%, the largest gap in the history of his polling. Those numbers are not at all reflected in the political leadership of the state, which is far more right-wing than the general population. Nearly 40% of Houston's population is under 24. It's an incredibly youthful town. So education is a pressing issue. More than half of that youthful cohort are Latino, and nearly 20% are African American. They are the future of Houston, and also the most likely to be undereducated. Texas is near the bottom on education spending and academic achievement. These failures will have national consequences, since 1 out of 10 children in the United States is a Texan. More than 7 million of them. 1 in 4 Texas children lives in poverty. There was a time when oil, cotton, and cattle were the only real sources of wealth in the state, and education wasn't such a crucial predictor of success. The question is whether older, wealthy Anglos are willing to invest in a Texas future that is predominantly not Anglo, when it's not a mirror of Europe, but a microcosm of the world, says Kleinberg. The hope for Houston and Texas is that it is in our basic DNA to do what's needed to succeed. Houstonians know that they are at a crossroads. This place could be either London or Lagos, my friend Mimi Swartz, a longtime Texas Monthly writer, told me. In early August 2017, an atmospheric formation known as a tropical wave stirred into life off the western coast of Africa and began its journey across the Atlantic Ocean. By the time the disturbance neared the Lesser Antilles on August 17th, it was designated a tropical storm and named Harvey. 2 days later, Harvey bumped into a wind shear in the eastern Caribbean, and it subsided once again into a wave. The National Hurricane Center stopped providing advisories as it appeared that the storm with its rather amusing name had simply petered out. The Texas Gulf Coast acts as a sort of catcher's mitt for the tempests that are hurled across the sea. And yet, with all the predictions about global warming generating more frequent storms of increased severity, we hadn't had a direct hit since Hurricane Ike hit Galveston in 2008. Ike was rated only a Category 2 hurricane, but it was one of the most destructive storms in Texas history, bringing a 20-foot storm surge and killing 84 people. Many of our complacent political leaders doubt that the climate is changing, or if it is, that human activity has anything to do with it. In light of widespread scientific consensus on these matters, it is difficult to read the political resistance as anything other than an abject submission to the oil and gas industry, which is headquartered right in the Gulf Coast hurricane strike zone. The depleted storm, named Harvey, lumbered across the Yucatan Peninsula into the Gulf, where it gathered enough strength to be termed a tropical depression, meaning that it had winds of 38 miles per hour or less. Suddenly, in the space of 56 hours, Harvey exploded into a Category 4 hurricane, thanks to abnormally warm waters in the Gulf. Harvey made landfall at 10 p.m. on August 25th at Rockport, a little fishing village and art colony north of Corpus Christi, with sustained winds of 130 miles per hour. Wiping out city blocks in Rockport and leveling smaller towns in the area. But it wasn't the wind that would do the real damage. It was the rain. As the storm veered northwest toward Houston and Beaumont, meteorologists began to panic. All impacts are unknown and beyond anything ever experienced, the National Weather Service tweeted on August 27th. William Long, director of the Federal Emergency Management Agency, FEMA, predicted that the storm would be the worst disaster Texas had ever seen. Governor Abbott urged residents from Corpus Christi to Houston to evacuate, but Mayor Turner and Judge Emmett quickly overruled him. "You literally cannot put 6.5 million people on the road," the mayor said at a press conference. He referenced Hurricane Rita in 2005, when an evacuation order had been given. About 2.5 million people fled inland, creating the worst gridlock in Houston's history. Steve Harrigan got his 85-year-old mother out, and it took him 9 hours to drive to Austin, usually less than a 3-hour drive. His brother-in-law left 2 hours later, and the same trip took 32 hours. People who were stranded on the highway died of heat stroke. There were traffic accidents. Fights broke out. A bus carrying evacuees from a nursing home caught fire. More than 100 people died in the thwarted exodus. The uncomfortable truth about Houston is that there is no escape in the face of a major hurricane. Harvey had become indolent. It just sat on top of Houston and the surrounding region, pouring more rain than any storm in U.S. history, measuring 51.88 inches at Cedar Bayou, just east of Houston, a record. An estimated 34 trillion gallons of rain fell on East Texas and western Louisiana. Nearly 100,000 homes were flooded, and as many as 1 million vehicles were destroyed. Dr. Joel N. Myers, the president and chairman of AccuWeather, predicted, "This will be the worst natural disaster in American history." The economy's impact by the time its total destruction is completed will approach $160 billion, which is similar to the combined effect of Hurricanes Katrina and Sandy. As it happened, I was supposed to be in Houston rehearsing a new play. I had planned to drive down on Sunday, August 27th, but Harvey got there before me. All the roads were blocked. My actors had already arrived for costume fittings, and they were marooned in the hotel. I had a video chat with them on Monday, and they kept looking away from the screen to the window where the storm continued to rage. Their eyes were filled with awe. My play is called Cleo. It's about the making of the movie Cleopatra. Elizabeth Taylor and Richard Burton are the main characters. Their illicit romance began on the movie set in Rome in 1962 and became the most scandalous love affair of the 20th century. I was radiated by their romance, which happened to coincide with the onset of puberty. I have been working on the script off and on for 20 years. Bob Balaban, the actor, is our director, and we had a reading at the Alley Theater in January 2016 on the little new house stage downstairs. The audience was wonderful, and after the reading, Gregory Boyd, the artistic director of the Alley, offered us a production. The roads to Houston were just beginning to open up when I drove down on August 30th. The Colorado River was well over its banks, and the sodden fields under the heavy sky appeared unnaturally lush, like an Irish landscape. Some of the access roads were still flooded. I saw an 18-wheeler trapped under an overpass. Only the top of his cab was above the waterline. I wondered what had happened to the driver. There were only a few cars on the interstate, including some freelance rescuers towing swamp boats. Nathan Rott, a reporter for NPR, ran into a bunch of guys with oversized four-wheel drive pickups who were forming up in Columbus, 70 miles from Houston. One of them told Rott, "It's moments like these, and only moments like these, that America truly appreciates its rednecks." When disaster strikes Texas, one of the most effective first responders is a local chain of grocery stores, H-E-B, which dispatches a convoy of 15 vehicles, including mobile kitchens that can produce 2,500 meals an hour, fuel tankers, portable generators, and disaster relief units that contain pharmacies, ATMs, and business services equipment. By the time Harvey made landfall in South Texas, the convoy was already on the way to Victoria and Rockport. Over the next several days, various units headed to Houston. On Thursday, August 31st, the Beaumont Emergency Management Coordinator called HEB to say that the city was marooned. There was no water pressure, no supplies were getting in, and the state wasn't able to help in a timely fashion. The HEB convoy charged through. That's my idea of enlightened Texas capitalism. As soon as I got into Houston, I went over to the theater. It's on Texas Avenue, in the heart of the theater district, only 3 blocks from Buffalo Bayou, which marks the northern edge of downtown. I had seen photos and videos that cast members had sent me during the storm. Texas Avenue had essentially merged into the bayou. The water was 5 feet deep in front of the theater. When I arrived, the streets were mostly dry, with jumpable puddles along the curb. The storm had moved off to Beaumont, but the wind was still gusting through the canyon of skyscrapers. I was prepared for the worst, I thought. The Alley had its first performance in 1947 in an unheated and certainly uncool dance studio on Main Street that accommodated 87 people. A sycamore tree grew through the roof. A high school drama teacher named Nina Vance was the founder. That same year, director Margot Jones created America's first nonprofit resident theater in Dallas. Until then, theater outside New York was largely made up of touring Broadway productions, but it is because of visionaries like Vance and Jones that the flow reversed. Most original works, such as Cleo, now start in regional theaters where they can be developed and find an audience. The Alley opened its current brutalist-style building in 1968. It looks to me like a 15th-century Venetian fortress, with turrets that have also been compared to anti-aircraft emplacements. is not the kind of building to concern itself with hurricane winds. On the street in front of the theater was a vacuum truck, a sort of tanker that is used in the oil fields to suck fluids and slurry out of fracked wells. It had been going for 24 hours, the driver told me, but so far had only gotten 2 feet of water out of the theater. I followed the suction line inside where the chief engineer, Daniel Naranjo, greeted me. Daniel's regular flashlight was out of batteries, so we relied on my iPhone. Upstairs was the recently renovated 774-seat Hubbard Theater, where Cleo was intended to be staged. It was untouched. We could have put the play on that afternoon, except for the fact that the utilities were all drowned. We headed down a spiral staircase toward the little theater below, but we only got a few steps before the water greeted us. The alley had been flooded before. The previous high water mark came from Tropical Storm Allison in 2001, the worst rainstorm to hit an American city until that time. Harvey eclipsed that mark by a solid 2 feet. Below the submerged stage was a basement, which contained the dressing rooms, restrooms, laundry, wardrobe department, and about 100,000 props from the 70 years of the alley's existence. All of it buried under millions of gallons of water like a sunken ship. It would take 10 days to drain the theater before the demolition could begin. The main problem, Daniel explained, was the electrical panels, which were custom-made, and would require at least 6 weeks, if not several months, to replace. Cleo was supposed to begin performances in 3 weeks. One had to wonder at the wisdom of rebuilding. Initially, it was thought that the water had gotten in through the subterranean tunnel system that underlies downtown Houston, as had happened during Allison. Since then, submarine doors had been installed, which worked during Harvey. This time, the floodwaters rose high enough to enter through an air vent the size of a sewer drain and blew out the reinforced concrete wall leading to the power vault. That sheared off a sprinkler head, which added another 1 million gallons of water to the gusher coming in from the street. Hanging over our rehearsal was the obvious question of whether we would actually have a production. Alternative venues were either damaged or booked. Bob Balaban was stuck in New York since the Houston airports remained closed. We were waiting for the axe to fall. The next morning, I walked over to the George R. Brown Convention Center, where 8,000 refugees had taken shelter. The initial chaos of the first days of Harvey had subsided into an impressive sense of order and gentility. The giant halls of the convention center were divided into dormitories for families, families with animals, single men, and single women. There was food in every aisle. I spoke to Scott Tancrey, an official with the Red Cross. I did Katrina with FEMA, he said. This one is a whole lot calmer. The death toll from Hurricane Katrina, which wrecked New Orleans in 2005, was estimated to be over 1,800 people, but no final tally has been made since 135 people are still listed as missing. Looters took over the streets. The New Orleans police disgraced themselves with their civil rights violations. Doctors at one hospital became so desperate as they waited for rescue that they intentionally hastened the deaths of their patients. FEMA was unequal to the urgency and scale of the disaster. In one of Governor Rick Perry's finest moments, he opened Texas to the refugees, and 250,000 of them came to Houston. As many as 40,000 of them became Houston citizens, aided by a multi-million-dollar resettlement program the city put in place. I walked past a line of people waiting to file claims with the dozens of FEMA counselors. Volunteers were sorting mountains of donated clothing. Actors in Disney costumes, The Lion King, Frozen, wandered around looking for children. There were phone charging stations, a table full of consoles from South and Central America, massage therapists, face painters, and yoga instructors. It was almost like a street fair. Rhonda Wilson, a Houston police officer, observed that when she first got to the center during the storm, it was a sea of helpless, desolate victims. 77 people had died, but that was a fraction of those who had been lost in Katrina, and even less than the figure for Rita. There are still people being evacuated, and the rivers keep rising. I'm living my life in 12-hour shifts, Wilson said. The night before, she had finally gotten a chance to turn on the television, and she had broken down. Like other police officers, her badge was masked, in memory of their colleague, Sergeant Steve Perez, who drowned in the flood while trying to report for duty. This city sprawls over 600 square miles, an area so big that Chicago, Philadelphia, Baltimore, and Detroit could all fit within it simultaneously, Manny Fernandez, the Houston bureau chief for the New York Times, wrote on Sunday, September 3rd, when the city was still partly submerged. The nine-county Houston metropolitan region, covering more than 10,000 square miles, is almost as large as the entire state of Massachusetts. 85% of homeowners had no flood insurance. Harvey calls into question the future of Houston. It has endured more flooding over the last 40 years than any other city in America, and yet it continues to grow by 400 people a day, building 40,000 houses a year to accommodate the influx, many of them in the floodplain, and continually paving over the grassland prairie that sponged up the deluges of the past. Harvey made the cost of the absence of zoning shockingly clear. Everybody got hit, Judge Ed Emmett told me when I visited him again, this time in his county office in downtown Houston. Geographically, demographically, it doesn't matter whether you are rich or poor. If we're going to continue to have this large urban area on the Gulf Coast, we're going to have to deal with flooding. Houston had come into its own after the great storm of 1900 wiped out Galveston, then the major seaport in the state. The Ellis Island of the West was the point of entry for tens of thousands of immigrants, especially European and Russian Jews. Wealthy and complacent, Galveston refused to address the hazards of its location, for instance by building a seawall. The city was only 8 feet above sea level at its highest point. The Weather Bureau did not heed the warnings from Cuba that a major hurricane was on its way. When the storm arrived, it brought a surge 15 feet high, drowning the island and wiping out the city almost entirely. The death toll was estimated between 6,000 and 8,000 people. It is still the deadliest natural disaster in American history. The survivors rebuilt the city with great determination, raising it 17 feet higher, but chastened investors wanted a safer port. They turned to Houston. The seeds of a great city had already been planted. Houston had streetcars and a railroad connection to New Orleans. A philanthropist named George Herman gave a tract of land for a charity hospital, which would eventually become the foundation of the Texas Medical Center. The bayou had already been dredged to facilitate the lumber trade, but that work quickly expanded when Spindletop came in the year after the great storm. President Woodrow Wilson officially opened the Houston Ship Channel in November 1914 by pushing a button on his desk in the White House that was supposedly connected to a cannon in Houston. But Houston had to face its own destiny in 1935 when downtown flooded. That's what got everybody spurred into action, Judge Emmett told me. A flood control district was established. Two large reservoirs were built to contain floodwaters. At the time, they were 20 miles from downtown. They were out in the middle of nowhere, Emmett said. Since then, some 14,000 houses have actually been built inside those catchments, a fact that may not have been disclosed to the homeowners. Those reservoirs were now filled to the brim. Many houses within were flooded, and the Army Corps of Engineers was releasing water to keep the levees from breaching, adding to the flooding of the hundreds of homes that had been built around them. I'm not a hydrologist, I'm not an engineer, but something didn't work, Emmett said. I asked Emmett, a Republican, if he was a climate change skeptic. The seas are rising, we have to deal with it, he said. I'm more concerned if we're at a new normal. We've had 3 500-year floods in less than a 3-year period, so our definition of a 500-year flood is probably wrong. Either that, or we get 1,500 years off. Emmett laid part of the blame on his own party for being anti-intellectual and failing to take climate change seriously. We've got too many people in our party who believe that the Earth is less than 10,000 years old, he said. Some of the political leaders are so afraid of this extreme element in the party. Periodically, just for fun, I go back and watch the movie, Inherit the Wind, about the Clarence Darrow, William Jennings Bryan monkey trial, which featured a debate about the biblical account of creation versus the science of evolution. I can't believe we haven't gone any further than that. Greg Boyd finally asked to speak to me and the cast about the fate of Cleo. Greg looks the part of a man of the arts. He's bald with a trim white goatee, and he usually dresses in black. The pain in his face reflected the bad news he was carrying. The lower part of his theater was being demolished at that moment. There were dumpsters lined up outside, crammed with drywall, moldering carpet, props, and rows of theater seats. Several of the city's landfills were flooded, and there was no place to put the debris. Similar piles of rubbish were all over town, where homeowners had stripped their houses of furniture and floors and had taken the walls down to the studs. I was touched by their determination to rebuild as soon as possible, but I also took note of the number of for sale by owner signs that had sprung up in neighborhoods like Meyerland, a predominantly Jewish section, which had been badly hit once again. Members of the alley staff had also lost their homes or suffered significant damage. Greg would step down after the turn of the year amid charges of abuse. It's been quite a rocky season for the venerable old theater. It wasn't a surprise when he said he had to cancel the production. I admit that my involvement in the theater world is tangential. I am a nonfiction journalist, deeply curious about the world outside, but not so much affected by the interior landscape. Actors are a little mysterious to me. Their emotionality, their expressiveness, their intuitive genius, all of this is about as far from who I am as nuclear engineers or trapeze artists. When I'm with them, I feel like I'm visiting a foreign country, a friendly place, but one with unfamiliar folkways. I once made the mistake of uttering the word Macbeth during a rehearsal in New York, and the actors marched me outside on a cold winter day, made me turn around 3 times on a crowded sidewalk, and then begged for readmittance. The Scottish play, you are supposed to say. When Greg delivered the news, the cast nodded. Then one of them spoke up, saying, "Yes, well, we just want to keep rehearsing." They all agreed. It was totally unrealistic. There was no venue for us. The alley was facing millions of dollars in damage. Even when the theater got back on its feet, there was no room in what remained of the season. Greg began to weep. The next day, the alley staff somehow managed to find space for Cleo the following spring. Shortly before I returned to Austin, there was an ad in the Houston Chronicle. "To our friends in Texas," it began. 12 years ago, you took in hundreds of thousands of us. You opened your homes, closets, and kitchens. You found schools for our kids and jobs to tide us over. Some of us are still there. And when the rest of the world told us not to rebuild, you told us not to listen. Keep our city and traditions alive. The way of life you love the most will carry on. You taught us that. Your courage and care continues to inspire our whole city. We couldn't be more proud to call you our neighbors, our friends, and our family. Texas forever. We're with you. It was signed, New Orleans. Chapter 4. Culture Explained. Texas enjoys the singular blessing that every distinct culture must have, a sense of its own apartness. It is in the sound of our voices, the flavors of our food, the rhythms of our music. Whether through the visual arts, literature, theater, architecture, music, dance, or cuisine, culture is a mirror of a million facets, reflecting the society it contains. Primitive cultures reflect nothing more than that. unauthentic, phony cultures mainly reflect societies other than their own. A great culture is aware of the world beyond, but is constantly turning back on itself, searching for its roots, examining its direction, criticizing and talking to itself. In short, taking itself seriously. From my lifelong field studies spent living among Texans, I have formulated a theory of cultural development. Despite the legendary qualities of boorishness, braggadocio, greed, and overall tackiness associated with my state, there is a lot to love about the traditional elements of our culture. If Texas is ever to approach cultural greatness, it will be because of the juice we get from the basic stuff we recognize as Texan. We might call this level one of Texas culture. It is the bedrock, the foundation that supports everything to come. Level one is aggressive, innovative, and self-assured. It erupts from the instinctive human reaction to circumstance. The paisano presses his tortilla. The slave mixes his cornbread. The cattleman rubs prairie sage on the roasting steer. And a cuisine is irrepressibly born from the converging streams of traditions and available flavors. Spanish priests mortar limestone rocks with river mud. Bankrupt Georgia farmers remembering the verandas of their plantation empire and mindful of the withering sun build high-ceilinged houses with broad shaded porches. Thus a native architecture arises. In scores of county seats laid out in the 1880s, the Virginian idea of the central courthouse square meets the Spanish idea of the town plaza and the Victorian idea of wedding cake masonry, creating an idiom of civic democracy. The imagination chases after memories of cattle drives and Indian wars and the mighty geysers of oil spewing depreciable assets out of the ground. And from these come the stories that power our mythology and inform our literature. The whine of the wind across the plains finds an echo in the nasal twang of our speech and the bending guitar strings. And so even today, our songs holler back to the once empty spaces where suburbs now sprawl. All of our culture overlays this primitive template, just as the Houston freeways inscribe the same routes once traced by ox wagons headed for Market Square. The persistence of level one in Texas is what makes it unique. You can still find the Tex-Mex regular dinner on the menu, and there are steakhouses that haven't changed since the introduction of bacon bits on the baked potato. Pickup trucks are as common on the city streets as yellow cabs in Manhattan. 1/4 of all vehicle sales in Texas are pickups. We buy more than any other state, more than California, Florida, and Oklahoma combined. And nearly every manufacturer has a special Texas edition. When people think of Texas, these things inevitably come to mind. Throughout my life in Texas, the state has been torn between level one and level two, which occurs when a primitive culture casts its eye on other societies to see what they have to offer. This stage coincides with the arrival of money. Whereas level one is aggressive and rooted and sure of itself, level two is consumed with longing, expansive, neurotic, uncertain of its own goals, but deeply embarrassed by its naive origins. Level two is the stage of sophisticated imports. It is in love with the old courant, which is to say the passing and quickly discarded fancies of more polished cultures. It is a voluptuous and rather bogus stage of development. It is easy to sneer at level two, but it is a necessary stage that any great culture must endure. It is a time of travel, education, and acquisition, the never-ending process of widening one's horizons. Level two cleans the dirt from under its nails and turns to the humbling work of civilizing itself. Classical music, Renaissance art, Elizabethan theater, foreign philosophies, and exotic cuisines. The world pours in and swamps the little craft of level one. The undergraduate bohemian reading Chekhov is indulging in the joys of level two as surely as the arbitrageur discussing the Matisse exhibit at the Contemporary Arts Museum over a plate of sashimi. This is all wonderful, but it is also in its way destructive, as one can easily see from the homogenized level two culture that has franchised itself and spread all across America, leaving so little of the original cultural imprint that made one place stand apart from another. The most explicit and enduring example of the influence of Level 2 in Texas is the architecture of our cities, which have practically obliterated their own native charms in order to become showplaces of other people's ideas. In the rush to build to the sky, cities have scraped away their histories and sucked the life out of their downtowns. When I moved to Austin in 1980, there were shops and cafes and even department stores along Congress Avenue. And the majestic Capitol dominated the landscape, as it was designed to do. Now Congress Avenue is shadowed by undistinguished office towers, which rudely leapfrog the three-story historic buildings that remain. The effect is like the mouth of a child, full of baby teeth and permanent teeth and awkward gaps in between. There is grandeur in the shimmering new skyline, but the human scale has been obliterated as Austin becomes just another big city. Philip Johnson and I.M. Pei brought architectural acclaim to Houston and Dallas, and these cities can think more highly of themselves now that the New York Times and progressive architecture have put their imprimatur on them. The buildings that have come to define the urban centers of Texas, the Williams, formerly Transco Tower, Pennzoil Place, the Morton H. Meyerson Symphony Center, to name several of the most elegant and successful of these, have added energy and an air of self-importance that characterizes any great city. They are world-class, to use a phrase that characterizes Level 2 thinking. But there is nothing Texan about these buildings, nothing that refers to the history or responds to the environment in which they are placed. One could just as easily see them in Boston or Sydney, but that's the whole point of Level 2, which is the achievement of a high level of sameness. It's easy to forget who we are in Level 2. We have wandered far from home and gotten lost in the cultural forest. What had seemed so secure in Level 1, that is, our rootedness and a sense of what we stand for, has been torn away and made to seem tacky and inconsequential. In many ways, however, Level 2 is a noble and adventurous stage, full of delightful cross-fertilizing discoveries. For me, the first gratifying step into Level 2 began with the arrival in Abilene of Kentucky Fried Chicken, a momentous and longed-for departure from meatloaf at the Officers' Club at Dyess Air Force Base on Sundays after church. Abilene was dry in those days, so whenever my parents made a trip to San Angelo, 90 miles away, to load up on liquor, we'd stop at the Lowakey Steakhouse, which was situated in a cow pasture with a dirt airstrip running across the road. We were a family of five, but would order steaks for three and then bag up the leftovers. Mother liked to have a beer, which they brought in a goblet she could barely lift. This was pure Level 1 Texas. When we moved to Dallas in 1960, I encountered my first pizza. It took place at Campisi's Egyptian Restaurant, which was, despite the Egyptian moniker, the first pizzeria in Texas. The only actual ethnic restaurant I can recall in the city at the time was La Tunisia, which was notable mainly for the 7-foot-tall fez-wearing doorman, along with cocktail waitresses dressed as harem girls. There was no such thing as a fajita in Texas until Ninfa Lorenzo introduced the dish in her revered Houston restaurant, Ninfa's, in 1973. I am aware of the scholarship on this matter, which proposes that the fajita was actually an indigenous Tex-Mex creation of the mid-19th century, which migrated south and ingratiated itself into the kitchens of Coahuila, Mexico, before returning in its full beer-marinated, sizzling, plattered, sour cream-dolloped glory. Level 2 is marked by the rise of cultural institutions. The opera houses, ballet companies, symphonies, music halls, museums, galleries, libraries, theaters, and schools that have proliferated in the last several decades. These institutions begin by importing other people's culture, and one hopes, end by fostering their own. To understand the anxiety that floats beneath the boast of Level 2, we have only to visit the vaulted sepulcher of the Dallas Museum of Art. Solemnly designed by Edward Larrabee Barnes, it opened in 1984, boasting the finest collection of post-war American art and the finest collection of pre-Hispanic art in the Southwest. It also laid claim to the country's finest collection of Japanese-influenced American silver, the largest display of Chinese export porcelain, the largest Robert Rauschenberg painting, the largest painting by Mexican artist Rufino Tamayo, and finally, the world's largest indoor sculpture by Klaus Oldenburg. Only in Texas is large art an aesthetic category. The DMA